I apologize for the delay, Council. We've had quite a busy morning and quite an exhilarating lunch as a result. Are you ready to proceed? Please.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the Court, my name is Nicole Walker, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Emma Watson. There are three issues before the Court today. First is whether the stop and subsequent search of Mr. Watson's vehicle and the occupants of the vehicle violates Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. Second is whether the state improperly elicited inflammatory and irrelevant testimony concerning the defendant's statement to police. And third, whether the sentencing court illegally relied upon Mr. Watson's 1999 trafficking conviction to declare him a habitual offender.
At the risk of disconcerting you, would you start with argument three first, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The state sought to declare Mr. Watson a habitual offender based on two offenses, his 1996 burglary second offense and his trafficking conviction in 1999. The defense appellant concedes that his 1996 conviction does satisfy as a predicate offense. He also concedes that he engaged in the conduct which occurred and led to his conviction in 1999 of the trafficking. As the Court is aware, in 2003, the General Assembly amended the trafficking minimum weight criteria from 5 grams up to 10 grams of trafficking cocaine. In 1999, Mr. Watson had a jury trial in which the jury found him guilty of trafficking 6.8 grams of cocaine. They found him not guilty of possession with intent to deliver and maintaining. Thus, from that verdict, it is clear that they found that he was possessing drugs for personal use. Looking to the plain language of both the habitual offender statute as well as the trafficking statute requires a finding that this offense, this conduct, does not satisfy the requirements as a predicate offense under the habitual offender statute. When the habitual offender statute was first enacted in 1953, it was designed to target all felony offenses. However, later in the 1970s, separate categories were created, the first section dealing with nonviolent felonies, and the second section dealing with violent felonies, which is clearly what the legislature intended subsection B to address. On the other hand, in 2003, when the Congress amended the trafficking statute from 5 grams minimum weight criteria up to 10 grams, it did so to free beds in prison of drug users and motor vehicle violators so that there'd be more beds for violent offenders, clearly indicating that the legislature agreed, in a sense, with the defendant's jury that, in fact, possessing 6.8 grams of cocaine is not a violent offense. Thus, if the court were to use that offense as a predicate offense, it would clearly undermine the General Assembly's legislative intent, which, if the court doesn't find that the plain language of the statutes satisfy that this trafficking conviction should not be used as a predicate, the legislative intent is also clear.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes, ma'am.
The 1999 conviction.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume, for purposes of discussion, that that was a conviction in Maryland instead of in Delaware. Tell me how things would operate in terms of determining whether that would be a viable predicate offense.
Your Honor raises a problem with the state's contention in this case, because under the Supreme Court law in Fletcher and Morales and such, what the court is required to do is look to the conduct in another jurisdiction to see if it matches the language of the trafficking statute in this case. Thus, there would be an inconsistent, absurd result if Mr. Jones in Maryland was possessing 6.8 grams in 1999 and Mr. Watson here in Delaware was convicted in 1999, 6.8 grams. the gentleman in Maryland would not be considered a violent offender while Mr. Watson would. Thus, clearly demonstrating...
Well, wait, I'm... Forget the violent offender business for a moment. Let's assume it's not Mr. Jones, it's Mr. Watson.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Watson was convicted in 1999 in Maryland for trafficking 6.8 grams, okay?
Yes.
And he also has the other conviction that you've acknowledged is an appropriate predicate offense. Tell me how the matter would proceed on the motion to declare him an habitual offender in Delaware with this one change of fact, namely that it was a Maryland conviction, not a Delaware conviction.
What would happen, Your Honor, is that the state would produce, presumably it would produce documentation that this is on his record. And then defense counsel would ask to have that conduct examined to determine whether it meets the qualifications of trafficking today. And they would use today's sentencing because today is when he would be declared habitual offender. So, and this court has said that that's the best and most just method in determining whether the individual meets that statute.
So if I understand you correctly, based upon existing Delaware law, his eligibility to be declared habitual is dependent on the fact that this conviction was a Delaware conviction, and a person similarly situated who had a Maryland conviction would not be eligible to be habitual.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. And in fact, there is, this wouldn't open any floodgates here, and it would make sense because let's say there is another individual in 1999 in Delaware who's convicted of trafficking, but he possessed 10 grams. By looking to the conduct, that prior trafficking offense would in fact qualify. So instead of looking to the technical classifications of what the crime is, it is the conduct that is important. It is the conduct which must be deemed to be dangerous to others and violent in order to satisfy subsection B. And again, that is consistent with trafficking, which when the legislature enacted the trafficking statute, it was targeting marketing of drugs in a pure and impure form, as opposed, obviously, to personal use. Possession with intent to deliver also deals with delivering drugs. The distinction between trafficking and possession with intent to deliver is simply that trafficking is based on an amount of drugs versus intent to deliver, which presumably is based on the conduct of the defendant. Thus, street vendors as well as major marketers are both guilty of trafficking and possession with intent to deliver. This drug user, based on possession of a certain amount of drugs, would be considered guilty of trafficking, but not possession with intent to deliver. And basically, the import of that is, again, that Mr. Watson did not engage in violent conduct because he was using it for his own personal use. Dealing with the first issue in this case, if the court wants to move on.
Yes.
Okay. dealing with the first issue in this case, the stop and the search of Mr. Watson and his vehicle, as well as the occupants of the vehicle, runs afoul of the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. On appeal, the appellant argues that the informant's tip is too vague to justify the stop, and the driving during suspension allegation also does not justify the subsequent search. In their response, the state argues that defense has no standing to raise this issue with respect to the drugs found on Ms. Clayton. However, though this is the first time they raised the standing issue, they did not raise it below. Thus, their argument should be deemed waived. In fact, they properly assert Kentucky versus Rawlins as general standing theory that an individual must have a reasonable expectation of privacy in order to have standing. However, the United States Supreme Court also addressed standing in Combs versus United States and Stegall versus United States. In Combs versus United States, the court found that the standing issue was never addressed below. In that particular case, the Supreme Court remanded it for further development. However, in Stegall versus United States, the Supreme Court found that the state had actually waived standing by not raising it below. Now, in that case, they actually it dealt with a search warrant executed on a home. There have been other jurisdictions that follow this rationale, including the Fifth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, Illinois, and California. Now, it's not to say that this is a subtle issue throughout all the jurisdictions, but it is a commonly accepted theory. In fact, in this state, back in 1972, in State versus Dunn, which was a letter opinion by Judge Bifurato, he addressed a suppression issue. And he indicated in his letter that the standing issue was not raised during the hearing, so that he was deeming it waived. So that is a theory that has been applied in this state as well as other jurisdictions. Since the state has waived their standing argument, looking to the merits of the case, it is clear that Mr. Watson's rights were violated. The hearing below brought about facts that on December 30th, 2003, Detective Cunningham received a tip that a gentleman by the name of Pee-wee often, on occasion, would have his girlfriend carry drugs on her person for him. The informant also said he's in a red Taurus and he's got temporary tags. Cunningham also asserted that he told him he was driving during suspension. However, Cunningham also relayed that he broadcast to the other officers only that there was possible drug transportation. Now, detectives Armour and Handy were in another vehicle. They located the vehicle. They stated that they immediately recognized Pee-wee as Mr. Watson and knew that he was suspended. On one occasion, though, Handy also says no, they had to look it up. That being said, assuming that they knew he was driving during suspended, they weren't the ones who stopped Mr. Watson. In fact, it was a third vehicle, Detective Christopher, who testified that, in fact, he had received information of possible drug trafficking. He was in the drug unit, and he stated that he conducted a stop which is more consistent with drug trafficking than a motor vehicle stop. The record is not clear as to whether or not he was relayed the information that Mr. Watson was driving during suspension. Thus, as a result of that, it's clear that his ultimate goal was to stop Mr. Watson because of drug dealing. And the state even argues, I think the state also concedes that they had an ulterior motive in this case, whether or not the driving during suspension stop was valid or not. Assuming it was, clearly the search went beyond what is justified. When they stopped Mr. Watson, they got out of the car, they drew guns on him, he and his occupants got out of the car, no furtive gestures, no attempt to flee, yet they did a pat down on all three of the individuals that were in the car. Detective Christopher said then I saw a digital scale in the car. I immediately recognized that as drug contraband. So the court below held that that was sufficient to continue to search the car and to take the individuals downtown for further questioning. However, an issue here is whether or not the digital scale is readily apparent to be contraband. In Hardin versus State, this court held that that is one of the requirements. A digital scale by itself is not automatically recognized as contraband. Yes, when it's taken in concert with drugs nearby and other contraband, it may be considered drug paraphernalia. However, the statute of drug paraphernalia says to use, ingest, or contain drugs. It doesn't say anything about weighing, but assuming that would fit that definition given the circumstances, it's still not readily apparent as contraband. Thus, the stop and search should have concluded there, but it did not, and they took the individuals downtown. And at that time is when they obtained the drugs from Ms. Clayton, which they used to charge my client. And again, since the state has waived their standing argument, and in fact, below in the original motion, the defense attorney actually even put the state on notice that Mr. Watson's vehicle and all the occupants were illegally searched. And of course, the digital scale is a threshold issue. Not just the digital scale would be helpful to Mr. Watson to having suppressed. In fact, it was the drugs. So they were on notice of that, and they did not argue that. Thus, the evidence
should be suppressed. Let me just ask you this. You're not contesting that there was probable cause to stop the car, correct?
Actually, I am in the sense that...
Well, the police were told that the driver was driving, his license was suspended.
Yes, there were officers that were aware of that. It's not clear whether Detective Christopher actually was aware of that. In his testimony, he said he couldn't remember. He said he stopped the vehicle because of possible drug trafficking. But then he goes, when he was further questioned, he said, well, there was something, I think there was something about driving during suspension. It appears that the lower court found that to be sufficient. Even if that is sufficient, the argument regarding the further search is still at issue.
Well, the police weren't entitled to peer into the car and see in plain view the digital scale?
Yes, they were.
All right, and even if the digital scale isn't invariably drug paraphernalia, on occasion it is used by drug traffickers.
Absolutely.
And in those circumstances, why, given that fact, and the fact that the police were alerted or at least were told that Mr. Watson on occasion was involved in drug trafficking, why wouldn't those two facts be sufficient to justify taking them down to the station?
Well, first of all, because the tip was not specific that there was drug activity going on at that moment, which is different than the state's reliance on trailer, where there was some support of the tip. Secondly, if the court were to find that the digital scale in and of itself is sufficient, there is a lot of material out there that can be used as contraband with respect to drug trafficking or use, including cigarette packets, spoons, glass stems, which I think would be more readily apparent. But if a sandwich was in a plastic bag, presumably under the court's, if the court makes a broad holding that the digital scale in and of itself was enough contraband, then that would open up, it would almost eat the rule of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. So that's why that in and of itself to be relied on for further search seems inappropriate.
Well, what would it take? The actual drugs in plain view?
If in fact the digital scale was found near some drugs, near a weapon, near some other contraband which might support the finding that it is contraband, or if the digital scale had some trace of drugs on it and there wasn't. But by itself, it is not enough.
I take it there's no empirical study that shows on the Delaware highways how many people are driving around with digital scales in their car.
No, Your Honor, I don't suppose that there is. But again, it can be used for a number of things. People buy scales to weigh things that they're going on a diet, what have you. That is a possibility. And unless you know specifically, it has to be readily apparent. And under Hardin, that's very clear. It has to be readily apparent. And when it's a bag, a white bag, or that looks like cocaine, that's enough. But in this particular case, it's not readily apparent. Finally, the final issue is simply a matter of a weighing process which did not occur below. The defendant unfortunately referred to his girlfriend when he made a statement to police that she was a quote-unquote piece of ass. The state on two occasions elicited that testimony from police officers. Mr. Watson represented himself pro se at the trial. And as the court is well aware, the state prosecutors represent all people. And while individuals who represent themselves don't get special privileges, it is important that the state be extra vigilant in what type of questioning they engage in. And of course, Mr. Watson did not request a balancing test, so this is a plain error standard. However, the probative value of this statement was substantially outweighed by danger of unfair prejudice. Thus, the court should have done a balancing test, or at the very least, a curative instruction, which was not
granted. Maybe it's inappropriate for me to ask, but what's prejudicial about the jury hearing him say what you just quoted?
Well, because, first of all, they were trying to establish the relationship he had with his girlfriend, that they were close. And they could have done that with different means. The prejudice to him is that the jury would go on to make a decision based on the kind of person he is, who he is, that he would refer to his girlfriend in this manner, versus based on the conduct that he actually may or may not have engaged in.
Well, wasn't it potentially exculpatory in the sense that it is somebody that he's showing by that statement that there's distance between him and her, and maybe somebody that he just paid to get into his car, and therefore anything found on her he had nothing to do with?
That is true. However, again, in the normal course of a trial, when you're dealing with counsel, there are ways to redact portions or language and get the same message across, and that was not done in this case. Does the court have any questions?
No, but you have your rebuttal time left.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
If it please the court. That statement was certainly rude, crude, and socially unacceptable, but it was not inflammatory. There was no objection. As to argument number three, I was talking to Ms. Walker this morning. We actually do talk to each other about that issue of argument number three. And I remember in the early 80s being before this court, and Chief Justice Herman, it was one of the very first trafficking convictions in Delaware, and Chief Justice Herman really giving me a hard time about, you mean possession? This fellow, Irish Shy was found in possession of, I think, about 7 or 8 grams of heroin. And Chief Justice Herman would just say, wait a minute, simply because he has 7 grams of heroin doesn't mean he's trafficking, does it? And I was, well, Chief Justice, trafficking is the name of the crime. It's not actually what you're doing. It's sort of like DUI. You know, you're not allowed to drive with an alcohol level, I guess now it's 0.08. It doesn't mean that you're actually under the influence. It depends on who you are. You know, if you're a 300-pound man or something like that, as opposed to a 100-pound woman, you can hold a lot more booze than. But it's simply where the General Assembly draws the line. I mean, that's okay. It's not what you're doing. It's you're not allowed to possess over 5 grams of heroin. Back then, I believe, when the trafficking statute was first enacted, everything but heroin, I think, was 10 grams. So if you had, you know, crystal, if you had coke or whatever, it was 10 grams. And heroin was drawn a little bit lower at 5 grams, I think. And then later on, as Ms. Walker pointed out, the General Assembly decided that they were going to up the floor to 10 grams for, I think, everything. I'm not sure about that. But unfortunately for Mr. Watson, at the time he was convicted, the General Assembly set the floor at 5 grams, and he has 6.8 grams.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that this exact same criminal conduct, if it had occurred in Maryland or any other jurisdiction, would be reviewed based upon the case law that says, well, you know, look and see how that matches up to our statutes in terms of what the conduct was, and that's how you determine whether he's eligible for habitual status.
I disagree with that analysis.
Oh, that's not what happened?
I would say that, you know, you have to look at the Maryland statute. If possession of 6.8 grams in Maryland is determined at the time of the conviction to be felonious conduct, then it would be felonious conduct.
Well, all right. Tell me how you understand it operates if a person has one prior conviction in Delaware and another prior conviction in Maryland, and the state wants to have him declared habitual. What does the state establish in order to satisfy its burden with respect to the Maryland conviction?
That it's felonious conduct in Maryland at the time of the conviction.
So the state doesn't, it doesn't matter whether that's felonious conduct in Delaware?
No. 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 And again, it would be, I guess the best analogy is with the felony theft. When I started prosecuting, the dividing line between felony and misdemeanor was $200. Then it went up to $500, and now it's up to, I think, $1,000. And I don't know what it is in Maryland. It may be $500 in Maryland. But if you commit felonious conduct in Maryland, well, we honor that. So if the amount of the theft, say in Maryland, the difference between is $500 and you go and steal $700, well, that's felony theft in Maryland. And that counts as a felony in Delaware, even though our limit is $1,000.
Hey, Mr. Donovan, let's go back to just the Delaware statute. And the felony in this case was a violation of Title 16, 4753, capital A, is that correct?
Yeah.
So if we look at 4214, the habitual offender statute, it lists the felonies that would make you eligible to be habitual offender, and on the list we find 4753A. But today, 4753A would not be a felony, is that correct?
Well, no.
It changed the rule.
Well, no. Capital A, it's still trafficking. It's just they upped the amount from 5 grams to 10 grams, I believe. I'm not real good at numbers.
Well, my question relates to the way 4214 works, because if you look at all the sections that are listed, they put in the word former specifically with regard to some sections like rape in the second degree. But in front of 4753A, they didn't put the former. So we've got this person convicted under 4753A, as it did exist, but it's changed today, and yet the legislature hasn't used the word former in front of it. Is that significant at all as a matter of statutory construction?
I do not think so. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, whatever it is defined at, you know, at the time, is what the felony is. And I think the trial judge, you know, picked up on that right away when he just look, at the time you were convicted, it was a felony.
Did you come across an ALR or anything else addressing this and doing your research?
The cases I cited, but
you didn't find an ALR on this subject?
I did And it didn't come out when I did the Westlaw search.
You might want to look at 19 ALR 2nd, 227. Is there any way to read the legislature's intent if they've concluded that this type of conduct today shouldn't be a felony if you're convicted based on that today? How do we know that they would still want you sentenced as a habitual offender today?
Well, simply because at the time you committed the offense, it was defined as felonious conduct. And that's all. That's all. They changed their mind. Again, think of the analogy with felony theft. I mean, they're going to change the floor.
But you're relying on a rule of construction, aren't you? I mean, you're asserting that the only time that's relevant for purposes of the habitual offender statute is the time of conviction.
Yes.
If it was a felony at that time, then it counts. If it wasn't, then it doesn't.
That's it.
The fact that it may have been defelonized later is irrelevant.
Exactly. But I mean, the General Assembly...
But my question is, what is the source of this rule of construction that you're advocating?
Well, it's the General Assembly's total prerogative to define criminal conduct in the state.
But in this case, as Justice Holland pointed out, there's arguably an ambiguity in the habitual offender statute, because in some cases it states that it describes a statutory section as former, and in others it doesn't. And it doesn't that at the very least raise a question as to in a case like this?
Well, I don't recall at the time the statute was amended in 2003 that people serving mandatory time for trafficking between 5 and 10 grams were suddenly released from prison. They weren't. That was not the General Assembly's intent. It was not the General Assembly's intent to defelonize or de-traffic these offenses. And I simply don't see how one can make that argument.
There's a difference between reducing a sentence because of a subsequent change in the law, which you're talking about, and the proper application of a habitual offender statute.
Indeed.
For a conviction that's taking place in real time, not in the past.
But at the time Mr. Watson decided he was going to possess 6.8 grams of cocaine, I think it was, he knew, or at least is charged under standard law, you're charged with knowing the law, he knew this was trafficking at the time. And he, eyes wide open, decided that he was going to possess 6.8 grams of cocaine. And this was, at the time, felonious conduct. It was trafficking in cocaine, and he went ahead and did it anyhow. And now he has to suffer the consequences.
But the issue is what those consequences should be under this particular habitual offender statute.
Well, the consequences should be that previous offense counts as felonious conduct in Delaware. And he should suffer the consequences under the statute. I see no other way around it, quite frankly. I mean, does the court then go back and worry about convictions for felony theft in 1983 when it was $200? I mean, it just opens up this... I think an untenable going back and second-guessing what's a felony and what's not. I mean, the statutes change all the time, and it seems to me the fairest way to go about it is simply to look at what the conduct was at the time of conviction. If it was a felony, then it counts as a felony. If it's not a felony, it's fine. But I personally see no other way around it. I don't know if the court wants to hear anything about the other two arguments. I think if the court takes a look at the trial judge's ruling on the motion to suppress A39, the court simply focusing on the digital scale, not on the drugs found in Marquita Clayton's underwear, and obviously the defendant had no reasonable expectation of privacy in that. And again, the other issue, rude, crude, socially unacceptable, but not really inflammatory. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In response to a few of Mr. Donovan's contentions, his concern about going back and second-guessing, the court already does that to an extent by looking at the conduct of out-of-state offenses. So it would be a similar analysis. We're not arguing that this defelonizes the trafficking. Mr. Watson still has a felony on his record of trafficking, and he still has to suffer those consequences. We're simply stating that does not qualify under the current habitual offender statute. Finally,
the problem is in that ALR I mentioned, just about every court in the country that's ever considered this came out the other way.
Well, the cases that Mr. Donovan cites, I'm not aware of all those cases, Your Honor, but the cases he cites deal with theft. And in that particular case, and it may be true of other offenses, I'm not sure, what happens is over time, the legislature changes the minimum dollar amount value due to inflation. So simply, the offense is still the same offense. In this case, it's not the same offense. It's a completely different category of offense. It goes from a minimal drug user to a major drug trafficker. That's the distinction. So in this particular case, that is significantly different than what Mr. Donovan asserts. And basically, as the court pointed out, the plain language of the statute is where we go first. And in this case, I would argue that the plain language is clear, but the legislative intent also backs that up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything to bring before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state.